Good morning. It's 6 after 10. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network today. The United States is experiencing what some demographers are calling a baby boomlet, a spike in birth rates. In 2007, live births hit numbers not seen since 1957 during the post-World War II baby boom. While some say the numbers are due to the larger population overall and the rapid growth, in particular, of the Hispanic population in the U.S., others are concerned about these numbers and their impact on our ability to deliver services like education and health care and the effects of an increased population on the environment. Well, joining me to discuss these issues this morning are a number of guests, one of whom is Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs of the World Watch Institute. Mr. Engelman will be with us for the entire hour. Joining us for this particular half hour of the program is Hans-Peter Kohler, Professor of the Department of Sociology Research, Professor of the Department of Sociology and a Research Associate in Population Studies Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Kohler is an expert on human fertility issues. Good morning to you both, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'll start with you, Professor Kohler. In 2007, there were more than 4.3 million live births in the United States, the most since 1957. What accounts for this? Who was having all these babies, and why were they having them?
So this trend is indeed striking, albeit not completely surprising if you look at the historical trend. So it's ultimately the combined factor of, on one hand, a growing number of individuals or women in childbearing ages who are likely to have children, and that being combined with a slight increase in the fertility rates, that is, number of children born per woman. And this combined effect basically has been translating into an increase in the number of births and, in the most recent data, to the striking increase, so that the number of births in 2007 exceeds or gets close to numbers that were not seen since the baby boom in the 1950s.
So we can't point specifically to one demographic group and say, you're responsible for us having all these extra babies.
No, that is certainly not the case. It's actually interesting that a whole set of factors is contributing to this. So on one hand, the U.S. white population, being the biggest ethnic group, has had a slightly increasing total fertility rate or fertility rates that basically traces very closely the national average. And so there has been a big contribution to the number of births by the white population. Then, quite interestingly, the fertility rates of the black population have been decreasing. So they were about 2.5 children per black woman around 1990, and that has actually also been declining and is now very close to the national average around 2.1. And the main outlier in this trend is the fertility rates among the Hispanic population. They are about 0.8 children higher than the national average. So currently the Hispanic total fertility rate, so the number of children born per woman, is about 2.8. So that's 0.8 children more than the national average. So basically all ethnic groups have relatively high fertility, very close to the national average, and much higher than some of the European counterparts, and that has been a major contribution to this trend. And the one ethnic group that is, distinctly different is the Hispanic population in most recent data that has had increasing fertility rates, so children per woman, combined with, say, overall increasing Hispanic population in the U.S.
What about other aspects of demographics besides race? What about income? How does this break out?
So before I get to income, let me, shed to another part. So the interesting phenomenon is that we get a, stability or slight increase in the overall total fertility rate across all populations, but there has been remarkable change, at a smaller level. And so, for instance, there's been a shift in the age distribution. Fertility rates tend to have been declining at younger ages, at very young ages, quite substantially, and they have been increasing substantially at older ages. So, for instance, since 1990, fertility rates for the 35 to 39-year-old women have gone up by about 43%. 45 to 49-year-olds by about 150%, whereas fertility rates by 15 to 17-year-olds has been declined by about 41% across all ethnic groups. So there has been this remarkable, you know, change in the age structure of the population. On fertility rates by income, I don't have the exact data in front of me, but I think that there has been a relative stability across different income categories. I'm not aware that the income fertility relationship in the U.S. has changed dramatically in recent years.
You mentioned Europe earlier. How does the United States compare with other developed areas of the world, like Europe, Japan, and so forth, in terms of birth rate? Are we doing better, or is our birth rate higher, lower, and what would be the difference, if any?
Before I get into evaluating it, whether it's better or worse, let's look at the facts. So the striking difference between the U.S. on one hand and some of the European and Asian counterparts is that the United States has a fertility level right around replacement level, so meaning that a woman gives birth on average to about, you know, slightly above two children, of which, you know, there would be on average one boy, one girl. So basically, each woman is approximately replacing herself in the next generation. And that combined with a relatively, you know, high level of immigration implies that the U.S. population is projected to increase, and that increase is likely to continue and quite substantial. So the U.S. Census Bureau predicts that the U.S. will add approximately an extra 100 million people to its population in the next 50 years, so approximately growing from currently 300 million to about 400 million. And most of this growth is likely to occur in the areas that already have a lot of the population. And in Europe, and specifically in the southern European countries, there is a, you know, striking difference. So if you look at, you know, the number of children born in any calendar year, the fertility rates translate to about 1.3, 1.4 children per woman, which is about 0.6 children below this replacement level. And if one looks at population forecast, this means that, you know, the European population may have reached its largest size at the moment, and, you know, while there being some uncertainty, is projected to start declining in the coming years, with these declines being projected to be quite substantial in some countries, including places like Italy, Spain, including also Germany, these declines being also quite pronounced in many Central and Eastern European countries, and areas or countries such as Japan and Korea ultimately offering a very similar pattern.
What accounts for the dropping birth rates in those countries? In particular, I'm thinking Italy. I mean, that's the headquarters of the Catholic Church, and they've been opposed to things like birth control for many, many years. And yet we see the birth rates dropping there. What accounts for this?
So the most important. Let me step back. So the influence of the Catholic Church is indeed very striking, and I think it's also important to realize that there may be substantial gaps between kind of the teachings of the Catholic Church and the actual behavior on the ground. So if you look at the sort of determinants of these trends, I think the most important one is the delay of childbearing to older ages and the kind of longer transition to adulthood that has been particularly pronounced in places like Italy and Spain. So what this means is that individuals tend to stay longer at home. They tend to live, you know, single longer after they leave the parental home, and they tend to have their children or marry even later in life. And once they actually have children fairly late in life, they, you know, tend to have one, possibly two. But what has become increasingly rare are third children, fourth children. And the key factor in this may be, on one hand, a relatively, you know, difficult, peculiar situation of young adults facing or having faced in the 1990s relatively high youth unemployment, unemployment rates, making it, you know, relatively difficult to actually establish your own family, establish yourself in the career. There are fairly rigid labor markets, implying that a lot of the positions that young adults held are short-term temporary positions that imply a fair amount of uncertainty and limited, and sometimes limited benefits. Again, implying that if you wish to have children, you face a, you know, substantial uncertainty about your income, about your future prospects, and individuals or young couples would tend to delay decisions that imply long-term commitments of resources, such as having children.
Well, so in countries where you're not, where the birth rate isn't at the replacement rate, wouldn't they, I guess if I was somebody who was alive right now, I'd be wondering if I thought about such things, and I have to say I don't spend a lot of time on this, but if I was thinking about it, I would be a little bit concerned because that would mean that when I got old, there would be fewer people around to help take care of me.
And the concern, so that is exactly accurate. The concern about low fertility has increased substantially. So there are various, there are repeated studies, what's called population policy acceptance studies, and they basically try to measure the awareness of governments, public officials, and more generally, I guess, the public about concerns about demographic trends and so forth. And if you go back maybe about two decades or so, there was basically no pronounced concerns about demographic trends and specifically low fertility, and that has changed dramatically. Issues related to low fertility, the determinants of low fertility, plus its implications for the labor market, for population aging, and the ability to pay future pensions have become a major topic of the popular public debate. You'll, as soon as I'm mention in these countries that I work on these issues, there always follows a long discussion right along the lines as we are having now. So the general awareness about these issues and a general concern that the contemporary trends may be very problematic and troublesome has been rising dramatically in the general public as well as among policymakers. And there is clearly research going on trying to identify possible policy measures to reverse this trend. And so sometimes on the local level, township level, county level, some places have tried to institute bonuses that are being paid for each child being born in a specific town. On the national level, there have been implemented policies have been implemented or are being considered that ultimately reward childbearing more generously. And now this debate is rather interesting because if we again compare the U.S. and some of these European countries, the perception is that European countries already have a more generous welfare system as compared to the U.S. Nevertheless, we find this disparity that the U.S. that has certainly for young adults, a less generous welfare system tends to have higher fertility. And we find low fertility in places that already have, you know, fairly extensive labor welfare systems. So these policies are being discussed, but unfortunately, current research actually does not pinpoint to specific policy measures that would be kind of likely to be effective at affordable costs. So while, you know, there is talk about these bonuses, changes in access to daycare, tax credits for couples who have children, most research suggests that the effect of such policies on fertility rates is actually fairly modest. So the current research actually does not suggest that there is a very easy strategy by just tweaking some benefits in the tax system or adding a few bonuses for children, that policies such as these would be sufficient to actually reverse this trend.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll see who wants to join us on this topic, and I'm also going to get Mr. Engelman involved in this too, because there are a number of ways of looking at this, and we want to try to explore all of them. And one of the things that's been in some of the news reports about this little boomlet, as it's being called, has been a concern expressed by some over what will happen in the education system, what will happen to our healthcare system, what if we're going to add 100 million people within the next 50 years to this country, where are we going to put them, and what are they going to be doing for work, and how will they affect the environment? So a lot of different things to talk about here, and you can join us on this topic if you want to call us at toll-free 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Milwaukee, you can use our local number. It's 227-2050, 414-227-2050. Email is always welcome at talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 23 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. Imagine an American summer camp where no one speaks English, and you can't either. Welcome to the world of language camps, where traditional activities like canoeing and hiking are conducted completely in Spanish, Chinese, or even Arabic. After three on Here on Earth, Jean Faraca and her guests take you to a very special language camp. That's coming up later today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about population, specifically a baby boomlet reported for the year 2007 with more than 4.3 million live births in the United States, highest number since 1957, which, of course, was in that post-World War II baby boom. Joining me to discuss these issues this morning, we have Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs of the World Watch Institute, and also joining us for just a few more minutes is Hans-Peter Kohler, Professor in the Department of Sociology and a Research Associate at the Population Studies Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Kohler is an expert on human fertility issues. Well, Mr. Engelman, I want to bring you in on this discussion. You look at this population spike, and you see it a little bit differently, and how would that be?
Well, no, I first wanted to stress I've enjoyed listening to Professor Kohler and learning a few things from him about this, and I think we see it reassures me that my understanding of the reasons behind this and what's really happening with these numbers is apparently not too off base, because I find myself agreeing with and much of what he's saying and feeling like it matches my own understanding. There was one question you asked him that before he goes, I'd like to explore a little further, because it relates to the to some of the things that I find interesting in these numbers, which is you ask him about the relationship of fertility to income, and he indicated that there don't seem to, he's not aware of any particular changes in this, that is, in its correlation to income. But I wonder if I could ask him before he does leave whether there is, in fact, some correlation, even if it's a steady one, to income, because my impression is, and it may just be an impression, I'm not sure I'm familiar enough with all the data, but that in the United States, and it's true in other countries as well, but speaking specifically about these births in the United States in 2007, that there is some indication that that there is a correlation with income, at least among women in poverty, that women in poverty do tend to have more children than women not in poverty. And on top of that, there's been some interesting kind of media speculation that there's a baby boomlet, a blip or something happening at very high income levels. I don't know whether there's an equivalent wealthy suburbs in Milwaukee to the Washington area and to New York, but I'm sure Professor Kohler is familiar with, say, places in Westchester County or Loudoun County here in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, where there have at least been news stories that very wealthy women are having large numbers of children, and the speculation is that it's kind of a, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and a badge of wealth, and, you know, I'm having a lot of kids because I can afford children. So not to speak any more about it, but to see what Professor Kohler has to say about this, I wonder if it's possible that at both ends of the income scale, there are, in fact, there does tend to be higher fertility than among middle-class women.
So I would, thank you, I think this is a good observation, and I would tend to agree that it probably is a U-shaped relationship between fertility and income in the U.S., and, you know, approximately that relationship having been fairly stable. So on one hand, kind of, and across much of the income spectrum, there's probably a negative relationship between say, household income and fertility, so fertility being higher among the poorer segments of the population, then declining to the middle class segments, upper middle class segments. And then there has been some speculation about, you know, that trend reversing once we get to fairly high levels of fertility, and I think that has been fairly reasonably documented, certainly for men, that very successful men tend to have higher fertility. It's less clear whether the same holds for very successful women, where that probably continues to be a negative relationship. And then there has been this recent media speculation to which you alluded about a growth in stay-at-home moms among fairly affluent couples and of a rise in third-birth children. And documenting some of these things on the national level has been fairly elusive. So I think that might be the case in subsets of the certain segments of the population, such as, you know, affluent suburbs in some major metropolitan area. But on the aggregate, or for the complete U.S. population level, it has been fairly difficult to document an increase in, you know, stay-at-home moms or...
Professor, I know you have to leave us, but there's a caller on who has a specific question just for you, so I hope we can get this in before you have to go. Steve in Green Bay, you're up. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Kohler.
Good morning.
I would like to know, would it be possible or feasible to bring the German medical insurance system over here, such as Mutterschutz, for example? I'm sure you understand what I mean. Mutterschutz, or the protection of the mother for being able to stay home for a year after having their children, and to make it more interesting, as well as maybe Kindergeld, which is what I think what I think should be done, because I see too many women just giving birth and then going back to work. Those children need to be taken care of, and I think something like that should be integrated in the American healthcare system. And I'll take my responses off the air. Thank you, sir.
Steve, thanks for that call. Professor Kohler?
So that question is pretty regarding a reform in the healthcare and welfare system, and sort of, as I guess all of us are well aware, these reforms of healthcare welfare systems are highly, you know, very complex because they're lots of vested interest, a highly complex system. I don't know whether it would be possible to extend, for instance, maternity leave in a way such as is the case in Germany and many other European countries in a U.S. context, or whether it would be the case to, extend medical health insurance, medical insurance to across the population. As you know, there are various proposals on the way, but it's a contentious and apparently complicated issue. So I can't quite answer this issue. On one hand, one aspect I know I can speak to is the question of whether there have been concerns with child outcome associated with the fact that there have been, you know, marked increases in female labor force participation in the U.S. and as well as in some other countries. And here the evidence actually shows that, at least on average, there don't seem to be, you know, negative effects associated with, you know, increased female labor force participation and associated with, larger institutionalization of daycare, basically children being sent to daycare centers instead of being taken care of by their mothers. And what also is interesting that, despite the fact that, you know, women have increased labor force participation substantially, the number of hours in which women and parents in general spend primarily time with their children actually hasn't declined all this much. So a lot of this increase in labor force participation has affected, you know, time in which caring for children was a secondary task rather than the primary task. So all in all, I think for concerns about child outcomes, it's less clear. There doesn't seem to be clear evidence that increases in female labor force participation and the, you know, earlier onset of sending children to daycare centers, kindergarten, etc., has had negative child outcomes. Now, that being said, I'm quite sure that there is important differences across the population, and if you look at poorer segments of the population, this may look very different as compared to middle-class and affluent populations.
Professor Kohler, I understand you must leave us now, but I want to thank you for joining us today and for enlightening us about this whole situation.
Thank you very much. I very much enjoyed the discussion.
That's Hans-Peter Kohler, professor of the Department of Sociology and a research associate with the Population Study Center at the University of Pennsylvania, an expert on human fertility issues. Still with us, and you can join us as well, still with us is Robert Engelman, who's vice president for programs at the World Watch Institute, and he's going to be with us the rest of the hour. We have an open line for you as well, if you'd like to call us right now at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you, so please use our local number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Well, Mr. Engelman, we have an email here, and we'll toss this up and see what we can do with it. Here's an email from John in Milwaukee. Could you please ask your guest how the increased population would affect Social Security? It sounds like the increase in population through immigration will help extend Social Security, or at least provide more people who pay into the system.
Yeah, I think on a simple basis, John's supposition is probably correct. People who are concerned about the future of Social Security tend to feel it's better when there is a positive ratio and a high ratio, ideally, if Social Security is your one concern, between workers and retirees. So one of the nice things about immigration from this point of view is that typically people in the labor force are those who are migrating in, so that you automatically gain a worker, raising that proportion of workers to retirees, and you don't even have to put them through school or anything else. Now, of course, many of these people who are immigrating also have children, and as Professor Cole was explaining, at least those who are Hispanic have typically more children than other groups. So you still have the problem of more children to educate, and that creates other stresses. But if your sole interest is Social Security, then yes, more births and probably more immigrants are good for the financial solvency of the system, all else being equal. And I'd stress that, because we don't really know what sorts of economic impacts will come from these demographic trends, and some of them could be bad for Social Security. But yeah, on that simple basis, people who are very interested in Social Security like to see more babies born and more immigrants coming to the country.
Well, you mentioned education and the impact there. And of course, in the early 50s, we had this onslaught of the post-World War II baby boomers who showed up in school, and suddenly there weren't enough schools. And we had, even through the 60s in some communities, children going to school in shifts. I know that, for example, in Superior in the 60s and even, I believe, into the early 70s, they had two shifts at the high school. There was one high school for the town, and they had multiple shifts going to school. Some started early in the morning, some started in the middle of the day, and this was also true in some other areas. Well, then we saw that kind of level off, and actually in the 90s, the birth rate dropped almost every year in the 90s. I'm oversimplifying a little bit, and now in this decade, we've seen a pretty steady increase since 2003. And I'm wondering if your organization sees this as a trend, or is this just a little cycle or a little blip here, and things are going to change again?
Well, no, it's hard to know. But you know, one of the main points about this blip that we're talking about today and that made news is that it really is to be expected given the overall increase in the country's population. The country's increasing its population by 1% a year, and we had about 1% more babies in 2007 by these numbers than we did previously. And the only reason it's really newsy that I can see is that it's the first time in 50 years it's been this high, so that the real news is almost more that family size has gone down so much since the 50s that it took us 50 years to have as many babies in the country as we had in 1957. And the reason for that is that family size is half of what it was, roughly, in the 1950s, and we have about twice as many mothers. So, you know, it's a simple matter of math that the final product of this, babies, is on the increase. So I would put what's happening to school populations in a somewhat similar vein. When birth rates change pretty rapidly, you can get sudden changes in the numbers of children, and education system demographers are very interested in this. They follow it quite closely because, of course, they have to plan their temporary classrooms and their school construction out, you know, several years ahead. So they look at what's happening to immigration, and they look at what's happening to birth rates, and they get very intrigued by these numbers, and well, they should. And what we are seeing right now is something of a return to what was happening in the 50s, where people who are building schools have got to be a little bit concerned. And I think it's possible, and this is a bit of a speculation, but that given the different circumstances now than in the 50s, the concern might be greater. And I'll tell you why. In the 50s, there was a lot of room to expand, a lot of room to build new schools. The farm fields had inexpensive land right around cities. Suburbs were expanding rapidly. Housing was affordable. GI Bill helped a lot in that, but it also had to do with the fact that there was plentiful land and plentiful housing. Gasoline was relatively cheap, at least compared to $4 a gallon today in inflation-adjusted terms. So what was happening in the 50s and then in the 60s was, yeah, you had these sort of temporary dislocations and kids going to school in shifts, as you mentioned, in Superior, and I experienced that too. But these things were fairly easily eventually worked out. They were sort of sudden changes, and demographers and school systems maybe hadn't been anticipating them enough, and so they had to scramble to accommodate all these kids, but eventually they did. Now it's a little bit more of a concern, I think, at least from the familiarity I have with my own area, the Washington, D.C. area, because school systems are very worried not just about space, but they're having to cut back on school buses simply because they can't afford the gasoline and the diesel that the school bus transportation is costing, and so kids are being asked to walk further distances, and often similar to what you're talking about with shifts that begin very early in the morning or go late into the evening, and suddenly kids are walking in the dark during the winter months. Parents are getting worried about this. So, you know, I'm not forecasting that this is unmanageable or we won't be able to deal with this, but it's an implication as the number of births continues to grow and as immigrants continue to arrive in the country, that it may not be as easy as a lot of people to assume to accommodate all the students we're going to be having, just speaking of education systems, given what else is going on with the rising cost of land, the rising cost of school construction, and the rising cost of energy. So I'm not going to predict anything, but I think that people who run school systems are probably more interested than most of us to see that births are once again setting records and on the increase.
Well, one of the things that Professor Kohler alluded to or kind of touched on, we didn't get into it in detail, that culturally there's a huge difference between 1957 and 2007 in that in 1957 it was still the time of June Cleaver. I mean, Dad went to work and Mom stayed home and raised the kids. And that was the social model of that day, and certainly that's no longer true. And sometimes Dad stays home and raises the kids now, but mostly we are a nation of two-income households, and in some cases might even be three or even four-income households, as parents may have to work more than one job each just to put food on the table, pay the rent or the mortgage, and put gasoline in the family car.
So there's
a tremendous cultural difference. So now, with all these children being born, who's taking care of them?
Well, you know, this was the question that I think was raised or alluded to by your caller from Green Bay, and I'm not sure I did agree with Professor Kohler's answer there. He may be right in terms of the overall research that there aren't clear indications, but I certainly have seen some that suggest that it's worrisome. And I'd like to go back to the point that he responded to in response to my question about income, to note that this sort of U-shaped relation between income and fertility, that very wealthy women are maybe having more children. I'm not sure this has been totally established in the overall literature by the Census Bureau, but seem to be having somewhat more children. And interestingly enough, the articles I've seen indicate that these typically are stay-at-home moms. They're women whose husbands, and this is no criticism of women who do not work and raise their children, believe me, but they're typically husband, high-powered and high-income husbands are working hard and drawing in the income, and then women who don't themselves have jobs are having three, four, five children in some of these wealthy suburbs. That's kind of intriguing.
And believe me, that's work.
Yeah, it is absolutely work. But it's interesting that they themselves, as Professor Kohler pointed out, aren't necessarily attorneys or running businesses. Or they might not have time to have so many children, or you know, maybe they give the care to somebody else, but they can afford it. What I think is more worrisome is this idea that women in poverty are having more children, because I'm not sure they're having them by choice or in all circumstances anyway. I think there's a very high level of unintended pregnancy among poor women, and I think this is probably true among immigrant women and non-English speakers as well. And often women in that circumstance are working not just one job, but two. Frequently, they're nannies for someone else's children, or they're housekeepers, or they're working in office buildings, cleaning office buildings, or whatever. I don't know what the statistics show about this, but that's certainly a scenario that one can imagine. And that is a concern about child raising. Because they have their own children, and typically more than middle-class women are having, and yet there is a real question about how those children are being raised and how much time they may be spending on their own. I don't know what the implications of that are entirely, and I can't document that that's dangerous or harmful. But I think one of the things that we ought to be a little bit concerned about as we see these birth numbers rise is what proportion of these births are the result of lack of good knowledge about reproductive health and sexuality and lack of access to contraception. Because there are some studies that do indicate that wantedness is an important indicator of child outcome. That is, children who were, in fact, the product of parental decisions to have a child, at least, and I don't think this is a black or white issue, but there is evidence to indicate that their overall average outcomes in school and in jobs and relative to the law and all sorts of things are better than in the opposite situation. And so that ought to be a concern. We don't know what the answer is to that, but we do know that on average, almost half of pregnancies in the United States are not intended. That's a shockingly high proportion, given the access to a sophisticated healthcare system that we tend to take for granted. But among the poor, and I think because we're kind of ambivalent about sexuality and reproduction, we don't talk about it as much as we should, and it's used a lot for advertising, but we don't talk about it much in school or in the home. We don't really know what to do about these things, and so one result is that there is a high level of unintended pregnancy in this country.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to switch the conversation and focus it a little more on the impact of an increasing population on the environment. One of the things that Professor Kohler talked about was he noted that this birth rate is increasing and the population is going to be increasing, and it will be increasing in places where we already have a fairly high density. Well, what's that going to mean? What's that expanded footprint going to look like on the environment, and what impact, if any, would it have on climate change? We'll talk about that, and we'll take some more of your calls when we come back. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:46. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up after 11. Larry Mueller's guest discusses the origin of words in the United States. She's Joan Houston Hall, chief editor of the Dictionary of Regional American English at UW-Madison. Words and their origins, coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. Well, this hour we're talking about the baby boomlet that has been reported in the popular press. In 2007, we hit a level of live births in the United States that hadn't been seen for 50 years. And that is giving some people some pause as we talk about the impact of an increasing population here in the United States. And we have held to discuss this issue for the rest of this hour, Robert Engelman, Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute. Well, Mr. Engelman, before the break, I started to pose a question. What about the impact of this increasing population, particularly if it's located in places where we already have a fairly high density of people, on the environment? And what about the footprint on the land and the possible impact on things like climate change?
Well, I think the first thing to say is more people, more demand for energy, food, housing, three areas where prices are already a pretty considerable concern. A lot of people like to say, oh, well, you fly across the country, say you're flying from Milwaukee to Los Angeles, you see all this empty land out there, there's plenty of room for everybody. But, not everybody can live in the middle of Nevada where water is short and farmlands doesn't tend to produce a whole lot of food. And you need to be near jobs and you need to be near our resources, particularly water, which can be in short supply. So people do tend to gather where there are other people in economic centers. There may be
Where the weather is warm.
This is also true, which is what's happening in the Sun Belt, and it's actually straining water supplies because often there's not enough water where the weather is warm. But an easy way to think of this, Professor Kohler mentioned that it projected to be 400 million people compared to slightly more than 300 million. I think it's actually something like 413 million people in the country in 2050 than today. So that's 42 years away. It's not tomorrow, but it's not that far away. So just kind of imagine everywhere where you see about three people, you see about four people walking on the streets, buying homes, buying cars, wanting to drive around. It's going to be a strain. I don't think there's any way around that. Maybe it won't be a problem. Maybe we'll be able to find new innovative ways to handle it all. Maybe there'll be major social changes. But the reality is people need resources, and we already have a pretty strained country as far as resources are concerned. Climate change is really interesting. You mentioned that, and I might point out that I've written a book, which I'll just like to mention at least once in the program, that treats these issues, the relationship between population, what women want to do about reproduction, and nature and the environment. It's called More, Population, Nature, and What Women Want, published by Island Press. If people are more interested than what I can say in the next few minutes, I'd encourage them to check it out. But climate change is interesting particularly because the country as a whole is pretty likely in the near future, I think anyway, just because it's going to be needed worldwide, to put some sort of lid on its emissions of greenhouse gas emissions. All wealthy countries in particular are being asked to do this now. And if we want to get a handle on climate change, which is, let me assure you, a real issue and a real problem, it's not some joke. It's scientifically extremely well documented that we're putting the world at substantial risk of potentially catastrophic warming as a result of putting emissions from fossil fuel combustion and various other activities into the air. And we're going to have to grapple with that. And the way we're most likely to grapple with that is by committing to a cap on these emissions as a nation in the near future. Europe is already doing this, and other countries are already doing this. We'll have to join them. And when we do, as our population increases, what we're going to find is basically there's just less for each person. So whatever that cap is, we'll sort of subdivide energy and chemicals and all kinds of things that cause these emissions among the countries now 303 million and in the future 413 million potentially. And there'll be just basically, it'll be just harder for each person to use enough compact fluorescent light bulbs and buy enough Priuses or hybrid cars or whatever to manage this transition. That doesn't mean it's impossible. We're going to be very innovative because we're Americans and human beings, and we're going to figure out ways to use energy much more efficiently, and I'm very confident about that, and we need to work on those things. But population is just it's a multiplier. It's one of the reasons that housing is so expensive right now. There isn't a whole lot of room, as there was during the original baby boom, to put Levittowns around cities. The best land is pretty much already occupied with housing. So if you go far out in the suburbs, then you're going to have to drive into your job or drive around the metropolitan area to your job. And at $4 a gallon for gasoline, that begins to get sort of daunting. So there are these strains that we're running into at our current 300 and some million people that are not likely to be made easier to deal with as we head toward 400 or 413 million people.
Let's take a call from Diana in Ferryville. Diana, good
Hi.
Morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've really been listening the last 25 minutes, and I've learned a lot, and in fact answered some of my own questions and concerns. But I've just been thinking, 20 years ago when I was in college, the data suggested that world population growth doubled every 35 to 40 years. And I know that that's not true in the United States, and I don't even know if it's true worldwide anymore. But I'm really concerned about the effect that when this other population spurt that we're having now. As he already suggested, it's going to be, an issue with urban sprawl. And, of course, the water, there's water concerns in certain parts of the country. That's only going to get worse. More pollution, global warming, hypothetically. And we've been really, I think, anthrocentric here in our discussion so far, because the urban sprawl obviously is going to inhibit the amount of diversity, biodiversity we have for other species than ourselves. And that's a concern for me. I just think if birth control were made available and education were made available to the poor women who probably do need it most, I just think that that would be hugely helpful. And I don't think that we should be giving any economic or social incentives to people to have more children. For God's sake, please don't do that. That's all.
Thanks for the call, Diana.
Well, I appreciate the call. I agree with much, or maybe most, almost all of what Diana had to say. I might put things a little differently. I don't know that poor women or poor people need birth control more than anybody else. They just need it as much as anybody else, and they don't tend to get it as much as anybody else. So that's really the issue. It isn't sort of preferential targeting poor populations to have birth control, but just making sure that there's equity, because that's what's happening right now. There's not really equity. Poor people don't tend to have as good access as wealthy people to contraception, or for that matter, to safe abortion. And on the issue of nature, I'm all for your ideas about what's happening to biodiversity. My book, again, Population, Nature, and What Women Want, the main title is More, talks about nature, and it does draw out this connection that it's very hard for nature to survive in a world with interstate highways that bring suburbs all over metropolitan areas, and have those metropolitan areas expanding until they begin to kind of rub shoulders with each other, as I guess Milwaukee does with Chicago to the south. These are all things to be concerned about. It's not like it's a sudden crisis. This has been a long, long trend of growth in this country and for the human population as a whole. But we may be reaching points where the public increasingly starts to see the connection and realizes that it's not bad to have, as Professor Kohler was noting, just two children per woman and being at about replacement. You don't have to be above replacement. And if, in fact, you're below replacement, because that's what women want, they only want to have one or one and a half children, on average, do we need to subsidize them to have more children? I would agree. I think creating the right conditions for a woman to be a mother is important and good, and getting dads involved is important and good. Sweden increased its fertility rate not so much by subsidizing babies, but by having parental leave, not just for moms, but for dads and moms, and encouraging that in businesses. So that sort of thing's not a bad thing to do, but actually having sort of a baby bounty, I think is pretty crazy. We should be celebrating the fact that women are strategic about reproduction, and that in Catholic countries like Italy and Spain, as John was pointing out, they're not going along with the Catholic Church. Incidentally, this Friday is the 40th anniversary of the Catholic Church's Humanae Vitae papal encyclical that declared that modern contraception was a sin to use. So it's another worthwhile media milestone to pay a little attention to. That didn't stop Catholic women from using birth control, but it hasn't been too good for poor people, because their governments have often not wanted to alienate the Catholic Church, and so they have.
I want to get another caller in here, because he's got something I think it's important for us to hear. Nate in Milwaukee, we're almost out of time. You'll have to be brief, but I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Thank you very much. I'll try to put all my points very quickly out there.
Hello.
First of all, hyperdensity is something that I think would be a good idea, because if you go to New York City, you have greater per-person use of mass transit, greater due to the shortage of space, conservation of actually how many material goods you go out and get. And in addition, the energy use per person is actually far lower than, say, out in exurbia, where the homes are getting bigger and bigger. Global warming, if you look at the birth rate, the developed countries are the ones that are usually the greatest offenders, and those are the ones with the lowest birth rates. And I believe you actually have an opportunity to look at and question if development itself is being done in ways that are harmful
Okay. And I want to give our guests a chance to respond to this because we've only got about 30 seconds left here. I appreciate the call.
Can't disagree with hyperdensity. If people can live densely, it probably is more energy efficient. Sounds good. Yes, the developing world has contributed more to greenhouse gas emissions to date, but in the future, it's more likely to be developing countries. So population is really important to consider in both parts of the world.
Well, I thank you very, very much for joining us today. It's been an informative hour, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Robert Engelman is Vice President for Programs at World Watch Institute and the author of More Population, Nature, and What Women Want. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. John Treader handled the phones for us this morning. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program number, 722E, as an environment. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.